The most fascinating part of stories about Canadian ecosystems is when we come to understand just how delicate they are. This is how it goes. It's a cycle. We start by instinctively knowing that everything must exist in a balance, to completely forgetting that in a rush for money, to slowly, over decades, realizing that actually, if we don't find a way to get this back in balance, we are all screwed. Case in point, today, a small village that for, I was going to say decades, but it's more like centuries, has lived in harmony with the grizzly bears that have always prowled the forests and streams surrounding it. Until, of course, we learned that there were an awful lot of salmon in those streams and an awful lot of really valuable trees in the woods. And you know how this chapter of the story goes. But fast forward to today, 20 years after completely unbalancing this little ecosystem and endangering the bears and the salmon and the humans in the process, we are trying to relearn what never should have been forgotten and slowly move things back towards harmony. And in order to do that, we might have to knock ourselves a couple of pegs down the food chain. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Jimmy Thompson is the managing editor of Capital Daily in Victoria, but the story we're talking about today, he wrote for Beside Magazine. Hello, Jimmy.
Hi.
Why don't you start, as we often do when we're reporting on something that's off the beaten path, with a bit of a geography lesson. Where are we headed today and where is it?
So we're in a little village called Owakino, and that's at the very end of Rivers Inlet. Rivers Inlet is tucked away inside of the central coast of BC, just north of the northern tip of Vancouver Island.
Tell me a little bit about the history of this place and its relationship to grizzlies, because this goes back decades, right?
Yeah, I mean, well, the village goes back since time immemorial. It goes way, way, way back, as do a lot of the villages along the coast. But this story really kicks off in 1999. And there's important stuff before and after that, but let's focus on 1999 for now. In 1999, the people in Owakino had to kill 8 grizzlies, and conservation officers killed even more. So there were more than a dozen bears that were put down that year because they were in the village. They were looking for food, looking through people's garbages, breaking into their houses. They were really causing all kinds of havoc. And they were doing that because they were starving. And they were starving because there weren't enough salmon.
The next obvious question is, what had happened to the salmon?
Yeah, so the salmon have declined all up and down the coast. And the reasons are both very local and more global. Locally, in a lot of these places, for example, Rivers Inlet, there were canneries. I think there were 13 canneries in Rivers Inlet alone. And these were big operations. So they were catching as much fish as they possibly could and stuffing it into cans. And that went on for decades. So during that time, the numbers did come down quite a bit. But what was also happening upriver, actually, from Owakino, was logging on a huge, huge scale, an absolutely unfathomable scale. There were 2 logging camps upriver and above the lake that feeds into the river that had their own airstrips. They were so huge. And this was an earlier era of logging. I mean, people have issues with logging today, too. But back then, there was no concern for salmon spawning rivers or streams. There was no concern for protecting the trees around streams to make sure that they didn't wash away, things like that. So these 2 factors were really big ones. So the overexploitation of the salmon and the destruction of their spawning habitat upstream.
Can you explain a little bit how logging can impact salmon habitat and spawning?
Yeah, there's a couple of factors. So first of all, you're taking away the trees, obviously. And when you take away the trees, you're destabilizing the soil, you're stopping the uptake of water that trees participate a lot in, so they sort of prevent the erosion of the soil around the streams. They also shade the stream, so they prevent it from overheating. A stream, you'll notice a stream in a clear cut is a lot warmer than a stream, and a lot siltier and muddier than a stream in the middle of a forest. The other way that logging can impact it is just directly. They're driving trucks and equipment through these streams. Now, I should specify that today there are a lot more rules around what you can do around streams, and it's not always followed, and it's not always perfect, and people say there should be more, but there are now rules, and they are, in general, they are followed.
So how badly were the salmon populations decimated in order to lead to the bears becoming as dangerous as they did back then?
This is a system that was used to possibly millions of salmon coming back every year. And there were four different runs, but the sockeye alone would have been millions. I say in the story, it was the kind of run that legends are made of. People said that old cliche, you know, you could walk across the river on the backs of the salmon. And I don't doubt it. It sounds like it was an incredible run. But by 1999, it was a few thousand. So it was this decline of you know, 99% kind of thing.
Wow.
It started to recover in recent years, but it hasn't gotten back.
So what was it like? You talked to a number of these people who still live in the village today, who lived through that time. What was it like living in a village when, you know, the traditionally cohabitable arrangement between humans and bears was so disrupted?
Yeah, I talked to one man in particular. I talked to a lot of people when I was in the village in September, but one man that I met before I went there, actually, his name's Frank Hanews, and people call him Fug. And Fug was the kind of guy who was in the village kind of known for his, toughness maybe, or sort of handiness. A lot of people in that community there are quite tough and quite handy, but he in particular, I think. And he was charged essentially with disposing of these bears that came into the village. So he himself shot eight of them. And that was really traumatic for him. These are people that had coexisted with the bears for millennia, but in their own lives, their whole lives, they had grown up around the bears, and they knew how to behave around them and how to sort of lead them to themselves. They had dogs. They still have dogs in the community that kind of roam around and are the first warning system when there's a bear in the community. You know, they've kind of developed these very sophisticated means of coexisting with the bears. So it was a real disruption and a real trauma that year to have to kill the bears and to know that balance had been thrown so far out of whack.
How did it start to improve? And when? Like, was it a reaction immediately after 1999 that, like, something needs to be done because this is dangerous, or was it a gradual thing?
I wouldn't say that anything particular changed in 1999. I don't think that it was so much that, you know, they saw how bad it had gotten and suddenly some major practice was changed and things got better. I think that there have been improvements that have been made, and the logging by then had mostly stopped upriver above Owokino Lake. But aside from, you know, fish conservation policy, which is set by the government, there's not really much they can do. But that's actually where the story gets interesting today.
Right. So what's happening now?
Right now, the people of Owokino First Nation are trying to figure out how much salmon the bears need. And that would mean knowing how much fish the people can take, because you're setting allocations right now based on how much is needed to spawn and then how much is needed, or how much people are allowed to take based on that. This would sort of put people a couple of pegs lower on the priority list. So it'd be how much the bears need and the ecosystem. And then below that, it would be how much there is needed for spawning. And then it would be how much is needed for people. So you'd have sort of a much more balanced take on the amount of salmon that can be fished.
So has the government gotten behind this new approach that puts the grizzlies' needs first? Where does it stand?
As far as I know, the government is not engaged in this process. The nation, I believe, is hoping that they will be able to then bring that to the government and say, look, you can't reopen this fishery, because they're afraid that the government will reopen the fishery for commercial fishing.
Right.
And so I guess the idea is the science is still in the early stages. So there's nothing been published on this yet. But they are hoping that they'll be able to bring this, I think, to the government and say, you need to consider the needs of the ecosystem.
What's it like there now in terms of the villagers' relationship with the bears? You spent some time there.
Yeah, when I was there, there was one evening I had been really desperate to get pictures of the bears for obvious reasons. I'm there as a journalist and I wasn't sent a photographer with me. I was there on my own. And I really needed to get some pictures of the bears. So I was begging people to take me out to the dump because the bears reliably come to the dump pretty much every evening. It's a reliable source of food for them. Unfortunately, you know, the forest hasn't really recovered in the area around Owakino. It's what they call a green desert. So it's trees of all the same age, and they block out the sun, and there's nothing growing below. There's no berries, nothing like that. So the dump around Owakino is actually one of the few places that the bears know they'll be able to reliably get food. So I went out there, and I saw the fence that they had built. The fence had been an electric fence, but the bears just kind of pawed right through it. They weren't bothered at all. They tore it open like a can of sardines. And so I think the fence had lasted about 3 days, and then someone stole the batteries. So it's no longer electric, and it's no longer really a fence. So the bears have gotten very used to being able to go into the dump and get food. And the bears still do come into town. One of the nights that I was there, a bear did come through town. Unfortunately, I wasn't awake to see it, or maybe fortunately, who knows. But people are still on alert all the time for bears. When I was leaving the lodge, where I was staying, the person who manages the lodge, Judy, she gave me a bear banger, which is kind of like a pen with an explosive tip at the end, and you kind of flick the tip off the end, and it makes a big bang. She gave me one of those to protect myself, and of course this other man, Johnny Johnson, who has been mauled by a bear, kind of just laughed at it. He said, "That's not going to scare them anymore. They don't get scared easily around this part of town. This isn't the wild where they've never seen a person before. These bears are very used to people and cars and guns and bear bangers and everything."
What is it like for those folks to live amongst an animal that has been so dangerous to them in the past? And yet still make the decision to put that animal first in making conservation plans? I mean, to me, that's the most fascinating thing about this story because, you know, to your point, those bears can be incredibly dangerous, especially after they've become used to humans. And yet these villagers are going out of their way to make sure that the population is supported.
Yeah, you know, I can't speak for them. But what I can say is that it appears that the people of Owakino have a really deep connection with the landscape around them, that it's supported them for so long. It's so ingrained in their culture. There's one man, George Johnson. I was actually in the community 3 years ago, I believe, 3 or 4 years ago, and he was just starting this pole. And when I visited this last summer, he was just finishing it. And it's beautiful. It starts with a bear at the very bottom. And at the top, and just above that, I believe, is a sea lion, and then there's a person, and then at the top there's this eagle with these big spread wings, and the pole is just gorgeous. And in each of the hands or talons or claws of the people, or the mouth in the case of the sea lion, there's one salmon, and that represents the different salmon, the different seasons. But to me, it also represents the allocation that they have in mind. You know, that this is just fair, that people should take what they need and leave enough for the other parts of the forest. And what's not included in this pole is the wood that the pole is made of. The trees and the forests around Owakino and all up and down the coast are incredibly dependent on salmon. There's a famous study by Tom Reimken from UVic from maybe the, I think, 1990s. That found that about 80% of the nitrogen, up to 80% of the nitrogen in these trees can have come from the deep sea. That gets there through the salmon. It's a reversing of the normal flow of nutrients. You know, you think about water falling on the forest, washing away the nutrients downstream into the ocean. The salmon are the thing that brings it back and completes that cycle. So the salmon, when those numbers were depleted, that actually impoverished the entire forest, not just the salmon, or not just the bears, not just the people. It impoverished the trees and the salmon berries and the ferns and all these things that make a rainforest a rainforest. So this system is incredibly interconnected. And without the salmon, without a healthy salmon population, that health is totally thrown out of whack.
So what do the Owakino people need now to maintain that balance? Do they need the government to act on their research when it's done? Do they need the cannery to stay closed? Do they just need all industry to stay the hell away for a while and let things recover?
I think what the Owakino would say, and I can't speak for them, but I did speak to a number of them when I was there and since. I think that what they would say is that they want the ability to determine what that threshold is, you know, when you reopen it to commercial fisheries or not at all, and what kind of logging happens and how that happens. I think it's acknowledging that control over these resources from the federal and provincial governments has been an abject failure. I don't think that you could look at the numbers of salmon on the coast and say anything different.
I hope that this entire delicate ecosystem can stay in balance. Thanks for talking us through it, Jimmy.
Thanks for having me on.
Jimmy Thompson of Capital Daily on his piece in B-Side Magazine. That was The Big Story. For more from us, head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. Find us on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. Find all of our podcasts at frequencypodcastnetwork.com. And of course, you can write to us anytime. The Big Story Podcast, all one word, all lowercase, at rci.rogers.com. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.